And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
The Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror!
Hello, Halloween hooligans! It's me, the Chris Keeper, with another four tidbits of terror to tide you over until next October. First off, we're going to start with the world premiere of my new children's book. My agent, Maury Frankenstein, told me I should use a nom de doom, since Chris Keeper rolls off the tongue like a meatball full of razor blades. I'm going under the name Dr. Noose, and this is my first book for children aged 3 to 5. It's called Smiley. I'll use my reading voice.
Smiley by Dr. Noose. Smiley was a little kid, and no one knew what Smiley did. He sat and smiled at the edge of town, and all the people walked around. No one liked the little child. No one liked how Smiley smiled. And when the daylight rays were spent, no one knew where Smiley went. When the morning came around, Smiley came and sat back down. People never looked or stared. They pretended that he wasn't there. The police didn't come within a mile of Smiley's creepy child smile. Passing mothers didn't dare to see if his parents were anywhere. But Smiley sat and Smiley smiled through winter harsh and summer mild. Smiley smiled there every day, and every night, he went away. No one knew what Smiley did. They all feared what his smile hid. And no one knew where Smiley slept, and no one knew what Smiley kept. The years passed by, and every day, Smiley sat, then went away. Smiley stayed a little kid, and no one asked what Smiley did. People sometimes talked of him in hushed up tones late at the inn. They shook in fear and clutched their cups. They forgot it when they sobered up. Still Smiley smiled upon the town, and everyone still walked around, until a little girl named Joy asked her mother, "Who's that little boy?" Her mother told her, "Never mind. Just pass and do not look behind. Cross the street when you walk by, and never look him in the eye." But when they walked by Smiley's place, Joy smiled back at Smiley's face. As her mother watched horrified, Joy ran up to Smiley's side. She looked upon the little child, and Smiley sat, and Smiley smiled. She held his hand. "I'm Joy," she said. And with one bite, he took her head. And like the end of every day, he got up and walked away. Her mother's screams awoke the town, and everybody gathered round. Morning came, and he returned, and rifles fired, and torches burned. At night, like every other day, he got up and went away. When he returned to sit and grin, 100 masons walled him in. Then with terror-driven zeal, they surrounded that with welded steel. Cement was poured, and dirt was packed. Fences placed, and warnings tacked. And when the sun went out that night, Smiley stayed there, out of sight. Years have passed and trees now grow atop the mound with him below. The town forgot who's in that place. They don't remember Smiley's face. But metal rusts and metal bends, and time will grind and time will rend, and cracks appear upon the tiles, and Smiley sits, and Smiley smiles.
Well, did you like that story? I'm sending complimentary copies to all the elementary schools in my neighborhood. Oh, excuse me. Seems I've kind of picked up a bug. Yeah, check him out. He's a big feller. I've named him Freddy. As we start getting into the flu season, I always laugh at all those people who bundle up and avoid everyone around them trying not to get sick. You could stay cooped up all season and still catch your death. As this next story, read by Luke Giaconetti, will show.
The Mask of the Red Death by Edgar Allan Poe. The Red Death had long devastated the country. No pestilence had ever been so fatal or so hideous. Blood was its avatar and its seal, the redness and the horror of blood. There were sharp pains and sudden dizziness, and then profuse bleeding at the pores, with dissolution. The scarlet stains upon the body, and especially upon the face of the victim, were the pest ban which shut him out from the aid and from the sympathy of his fellow men. And the whole seizure, progress, and termination of the disease were the incidents of half an hour. But the Prince Prospero was happy and dauntless and sagacious. When his dominions were half depopulated, he summoned to his presence 1,000 hale and light-hearted friends from among the knights and dames of his court, and with these retired to the deep seclusion of one of his castellated abbeys. This was an extensive and magnificent structure, the creation of the prince's own eccentric yet august taste. A strong and lofty wall girdled in it. This wall had gates of iron. The courtiers, having entered, brought furnaces and massy hammers and welded the bolts. They resolved to leave means neither of ingress nor egress to the sudden impulses of despair or of frenzy from within. The abbey was amply provisioned. With such precautions, the courtiers might bid defiance to contagion. The external world could take care of itself. In the meantime, it was folly to grieve or to think. The prince had provided all the appliances of pleasure. There were buffoons. There were improvisatori. There were ballet dancers, there were musicians, there was beauty, there was wine. All these and security were within. Without was the Red Death. It was towards the close of the 5th or 6th month of his seclusion, and while the pestilence raged most furiously abroad, that the Prince Prospero entertained his 1,000 friends at a masked ball of the most unusual magnificence. It was a voluptuous scene, that masquerade, but first let me tell you of the rooms in which it was held. There were 7, an imperial suite. In many palaces, however, such suites form a long and straight vista, while the folding doors slide back to nearly the walls on either hand, so that the view of the whole extent is scarcely impeded. Here the case was different, as might have been expected from the Duke's love of the bizarre. The apartments were so irregularly disposed that the vision embraced but little more than one at a time. There was a sharp turn at every 20 or 30 yards, and at each turn a novel effect. To the right and left, in the middle of each wall, a tall and narrow Gothic window looked out upon a close corridor which pursued the windings of the suite. These windows were of stained glass, whose color varied in accordance with the prevailing hue of the decorations of the chamber into which it opened. That at the eastern extremity was hung, for example, in blue, and vividly blue were its windows. The second chamber was purple in its ornaments and tapestries, and here the panes were purple. The third was green throughout, and so were the casements. The fourth was furnished and lighted with orange, the fifth with white, the sixth with violet. The 7th apartment was closely shrouded in black velvet tapestries that hung all over the ceiling and down the walls, falling in heavy folds upon a carpet of the same material and hue. But in this chamber only, The color of the windows failed to correspond with the decorations. The panes here were scarlet, a deep blood color. Now, in no one of the seven apartments was there any lamp or candelabrum, amid the profusion of golden ornaments that lay scattered to and fro, depended from the roof. There was no light of any kind emanating from the lamp or candle within the suite of chambers. But in the corridors that followed the suite, there stood, opposite to each window, a heavy tripod, bearing a brazier of fire, that projected its rays through the tinted glass, and so glaringly illuminated the room. And thus were produced a multitude of gaudy and fantastic appearances. But in the western, or black chamber, the effect of the firelight that streamed upon the dark hangings through the blood-tinted panes was ghastly in the extreme, and produced so wild a look upon the countenances of those who entered that there were few of the company bold enough to set few within its precincts at all. It was in this apartment also that there stood against the western wall a gigantic clock of ebony. Its pendulum swung to and fro with dull, heavy, monotonous clang, and when the minute hand made the circuit of the face, and the hour was to be stricken, there came from the brazen lungs of the clock a sound which was clear, and loud, and deep, and exceedingly musical, but of so peculiar a note and emphasis that, at each lapse of an hour, the musicians of the orchestra were constrained to pause, momentarily, in their performance, to hearken to the sound. And thus the waltzers perforce ceased their evolutions, and there was a brief disconcert of the whole gay company. And while the chimes of the clock yet rang, it was observed that the giddiest grew pale, and the more aged and sedate passed their hands over their brows, as if in confused reverie or meditation. But when the echoes had fully ceased, a light laughter at once pervaded the assembly. The musicians looked at each other and smiled as if their own nervousness and folly, and made whispering vows each to the other, that the next chiming of the clock should produce in them no similar emotion. And then, after the lapses of 60 minutes, which embrace 3,600 seconds of the time that flies, there came yet another chiming of the clock, and then were the same disconcert and tremulousness and mediation as before. But in spite of these things, it was a gay and magnificent revel. The tastes of the Duke were peculiar. He had a fine eye for colors and effects. He disregarded the decora of mere fashion. His plans were bold and fiery, and his conceptions glowed with barbaric luster. There are some who would not have thought him mad. His followers felt that he was not. It was necessary to hear and see and touch him to be sure that he was not. He had directed, in great part, the movable embellishments of the seven chambers upon occasion of this great fête, and it was his own guiding taste which had given character to the masqueraders. Be sure they were grotesque. There were much glare and glitter and piquancy and phantasm, much of what has since seen in Herrini. There were arabesque figures with unsuited limbs and appointments. There were delirious fancies such as the madmen fashions. There were some of the beautiful, much of the wanton, much of the bizarre, something of the terrible, and not a little of that which might have excited disgust. To and fro in the seven chambers there stalked, in fact, a multitude of dreams. And these, the dreams, writhed in and about, taking hue from the rooms, and causing the wild music of the orchestra to seem as the echo of their steps. And anon, there strikes the ebony clock which stands in the hall of the velvet. And then, for a moment, all is still, and all is silent save the voice of the clock. The dreams are stiff frozen as they stand. But the echoes of the chime die away. They have endured but an instant. And a light, half-subdued laughter floats after them as they depart. And now again the music swells, and the dreams live, and writhe to and fro more merrily than ever, taking hue from the many tinted windows through which stream the rays from the tripods. But to the chamber which lies most westwardly of the seven, there are now none of the masters who venture, for the night is waning away, and there flows a ruddier light through the blood-colored panes, and the blackness of the sable drapery appalls. And to him whose foot falls upon the sable carpet, there comes from the near clock of ebony muffled peal, more solemnly emphatic than any which reaches their ears who indulge in the more remote gaieties of the other apartments. But these other apartments were densely crowded, and in them beat feverishly the heart of life. And the revel went whirlingly on, until at length there commenced a sounding of midnight upon the clock. And then the music ceased, as I have told, and the evolutions of the waltzers were quieted, and there was an uneasy cessation of all things as before. But now there were 12 strokes to be sounded by the bell of the clock, and thus it happened, perhaps, that more of the thought crept, with more of time, into the mediations of the thoughtful among those who reveled. And thus, too, it happened, perhaps, that before the last echoes of the last chime had utterly sunk into silence, there were many individuals in the crowd who had found leisure to become aware of the presence of a masked figure which had arrested the attention of no single individual before. And the rumor of this new presence having spread itself whisperingly around, there arose at length from the whole company a buzz or murmur, expressive of disapprobation, surprise, then finally of terror, of horror, and of disgust. In an assembly of phantasms such as I have painted, it may well be supposed that no ordinary appearance could have excited such sensation. In truth, the masquerade license of the night was nearly unlimited, but the figure in question had out-Heroded Herod, and gone beyond the bounds of even the prince's indefinite decorum. There are choices in the hearts of the most reckless which cannot be touched without emotion. Even with the utterly lost, to whom life and death are equally jests, there are matters of which no jest can be made. The whole company, indeed, seemed now deeply to feel that in the costume and bearing of the stranger neither wit nor propriety existed. The figure was tall and gaunt, shrouded from head to foot in the habiliments of the grave. The mask which concealed the visage was made so nearly to resemble the countenance of a stiffened corpse that the closest scrutiny must have had difficulty in detecting the cheat. And yet all this might have endured, if not approved, by the mad revelers around. But the mummer had gone so far as to assume the type of the Red Death. His venture was dabbled in blood, with his broad brow, with all the features of the face, was besprinkled with the scarlet horror. When the eyes of Prince Prospero fell upon the spectral image which, with a slow and solemn movement, as if it were more fully to sustain its role, stalked to and fro among the waltzers, he was seen to be convulsed, in the first moment with a strong shudder either of terror or distaste, but in the next, his brow reddened with rage. "Who dares," he demanded hoarsely of the courtiers who stood near him, "who dares insult us with this blasphemous mockery? Seize him and unmask him, that we may know whom we have to hang at sunrise from the battlements." It was in the eastern or blue chamber in which stood the Prince Prospero as he uttered these words. They rang throughout the seven rooms loudly and clearly, for the prince was a bold and robust man, and music had hushed at the waving of his hand. It was in the blue room where stood the prince, with a group of pale courtiers by his side. At first, as he spoke, there was a slight rushing movement of this group in the direction of the intruder, who at the moment was also near at hand, and now, with deliberate and stately step, made closer approach to the speaker. But from a certain nameless awe with which the mad assumptions of the mummer had inspired the whole party, there were found none who put forth hand to seize him, so that, unimpeded, he passed within a yard of the prince's person, and while the vast assembly, as if with one impulse, shrank from the centers of the rooms to the walls, he made his way uninterruptedly, but with the same solemn and measured step which had distinguished him from the first, through the blue chamber to the purple, through the purple to the green, through the green to the orange, through this again to the white, and even thence to the violet, ere a decided movement had been made to arrest him. It was then, however, that the Prince Prospero, maddening with rage and the shame of his own momentary cowardice, rushed hurriedly through the six chambers, while none followed him on account of a deadly terror that had seized upon all. He bore aloft a drawn dagger, and then approached in rapid impetuosity to within 3 or 4 feet of the retreating figure, when the latter, having attained the extremity of the velvet apartment, turned suddenly and confronted his pursuer. There was a sharp cry, and the dagger dropped gleaming upon the sable carpet, upon which, instantly afterwards, fell prostrate in death the Prince Prospero. Then summoning the wild courage of despair, a throng of the revelers at once threw themselves into the black apartment, and seizing the mummer, whose tall figure stood erect and motionless within the shadow of the ebony clock, gasped in unutterable horror at finding the grave cerements and corpse-like mask, which they handled with so violent a rudeness, untenanted by any tangible form. And now was acknowledged the presence of the Red Death. He had come like a thief in the night, and one by one dropped the revelers in the blood-bedewed halls of their revel, and died each in the despairing posture of his fall. And the life of the ebony clock went out with that of the last of the gay, and the flames of the tripods expired, and darkness and decay and the Red Death held illimitable dominion over all.
A rough party for Prince Prospero, but I still have to rate it above that one New Year's Eve where Dr. Deadly downed 3 Irish car bombs and puked into the aquarium. Speaking of aquariums, better put on your rubbers and raincoats, because you will get wet on this next ride. It's a little attraction by the hair metal hero called...
Rain. The rain was dropping in what could only be described as hammers as the sun sank lower in the sky. Mike Thompson hated the rain. He hated its coldness, the graying sky it carried with it, and the dense oppression that seemed to stir in his chest any time it was near. Mike peered out of his window. "Fucking rain," he said coldly. Forget the fact that rain kept flora and fauna alive, or the trite symbolism of it representing baptism or new birth in the movies. For Mike, it was just the fucking rain. There was never anything good he could attach the rain with. It flooded his home as a child, killed the sun, canceled sports, and generally just depressed the fuck out of him. The rain swallowed all. Mike was never pleasant when the rain came. Mike sat in his recliner, disinterestedly flipping through the latest issue of Sports Illustrated. The rain continued thumping his windows in steady drumbeat fashion, and his mood sank lower. "Can't a guy catch a break?" he mumbled to himself lowly. Mike lost his job at the mill several months ago, and his unemployment was winding inexorably to its end. And still, the rain. Mike never could get a relationship to last, never thinking his massive rain-related mood swings may have had something to do with it. His drinking got worse every day since he lost his job. At least it killed the time well enough, and everyone needs a hobby. And still, the rain. As the sun finally dipped below the horizon, and its last low beams dissipated from his skylight, Mike readied himself for dinner. It was a meager meal of grilled cheese and stale potato chips, but it sufficed. The main course was the pint of gin he downed like water, followed by the last 3 High Lifes in the fridge. And still, the rain. Mike ate quickly and resumed his boredom. The drumbeat of the rain intensified through the house. To Mike, it was not the sound of renewal, but of a dire, black dismay. Mike felt himself nodding off in his chair. With nothing to hold his attention, and all out of booze, he succumbed to sweet unconsciousness. And still, the rain. Mike jolted awake as the thunder shocked him from his slumber. His heart was pounding, keeping time with the deluge that had intensified as he had slept. He had a headache, the early start of an oncoming hangover. He must have been out for several hours, he thought. It was black as pitch. He hadn't gotten the lights on before he slept, and between the darkness, the noise, and the shock of a horrific return to the waking world, Mike was unaware of the moisture building up on his floor. "Goddamn fucking rain," Mike shouted, exasperated by the situation. He frantically checked all of his doors and windows, but it was too late. The rain was inside, and he wasn't cognizant of it yet, but it certainly was aware of him. And still, the rain. Mike managed to feel secure in his locking up ability, but he wasn't completely comfortable. Christ, he wanted a drink. His power had gone out, and he managed to get his flashlight fired up so he wouldn't trip and kill himself in the dark. It was only after Mike sat himself back down that he noticed the omnipresent moisture surrounding him. Mike could feel the unease in his stomach growing. He began to comprehend the wetness inside of his shoes. A minor annoyance to some. To Mike, it was the harbinger of some dread fear. And still, the rain. "Fucking rain's gonna flood me, my house, everything. Just like when I was a kid. Damn it, damn it, damn it." The storm continued unrelenting, even as Mike grumbled his excoriations. "Did I do something wrong in my life? How much rain has to fall on me? It's not fair."
"No, it's not," came a gurgling voice from out of the darkness.
"Who is that? What do you want?"
"I want you, Michael."
"Where are you? What are you?"
"I'm all around you, Michael. In every dewdrop, every beat of rain that assaults your shithole of a home, every splash from your sink, every dark thought you've ever had made manifest in perfect lunar form. I'm the rainstorm above your head and in your heart. I'm the darkest, blackest, wettest part of you, Michael. Fuck you. This isn't real. It can't be real. Then look, Michael. The formless pool that was growing on Mike's floor shuddered and bubbled. The wetness around Mike slowly coalesced into a man-shaped thing. In the dimness of the flashlight, Mike perceived the shape. It was translucent. The beam of light scattered upon the walls as its constantly moving and shifting form played with the lights like a disco ball from Hell's Nightclub. And then he saw the face of the thing. Or rather, he saw what wasn't there. The featureless creep was certainly in the shape of a man, slick and blank, reflecting back at Mike all his worst feelings. The gurgling continued as the rain pounded the windows, and Mike sank lower into his chair. Why? Mike said, defeated, his spirit crushed by the unreality of it all. Because men like you are so easy, Michael. Woe is me. Poor me. This sucks. That blows. Poor, poor me. Pathetic. You are a simpering, useless thing. A perfect throwaway person. You've given up on life. Hell, you never even tried living. Something was always wrong. Someone was always to blame. No girlfriend, boo-hoo, you dour fuck. Why do you think that is? No career. No ambition. No responsibility either. Please. Mike was plastered in his chair now, unmoving, feeling the creature's words cutting him to the bone. I want your pathetic, rotten soul, Michael. I want to drink from you your misery the way you try to drink away yours. The fiend slid effortlessly over to Mike. The rain outside was steady, and nothing was going to change it. Mike started whispering his prayers through clenched teeth while the creature leaned closer.
Oh, hush, Michael. There's no prayer for the dying.
Mike prayed faster and louder now. The rain was on top of him and all around him. It was flooding his house from the ground up.
You seem to be all out of drink, Michael. Let me help you with that.
The wetness struck Mike like a steamroller. He barely managed to get out half a scream before the rain began forcing itself into his gullet, gurgling a wet laugh as it wound its way into him.
Drink.
And still, the rain. Something in Mike shuddered as his life bubbled away almost silently. The rain consumed him as he consumed it. His eyes were lifeless, his house a shambles, as he floated through the empty house he came to rest under the skylight. Unblinking and unmoving, his frozen stare gazing up through the roof into the murky sky. A perfect throwaway person. And still, the rain.
Yes, that guy's attitude was all wet. Better add a life preserver to your raincoat, because we're about to take a little sea cruise on the HMS Holy Shit! Directly to the portal where all my squishy aquatic pals live. It's a happy little tale by H.P. Lovecraft that will make you think twice about eating that calamari on your plate. Take it away, Captain Sean Engel.
Dagon, by H.P. Lovecraft. I'm writing this under appreciable mental strain, since by tonight, I shall be no more. Penniless and at the end of my supply of the drug which alone makes life endurable, I can bear the torture no longer, and shall cast myself from this garret window into the squalid street below. Do not think for my slavery to morphine that I am a weakling or a degenerate. When you have read these hastily scrawled pages, you may guess, though never fully realize, why it is that I must have forgetfulness or death. It was in one of the most open and least frequented parts of the broad Pacific that the packet of which I was supercargo fell victim to the German sea raider. The Great War was then in its very beginning, and the ocean forces of the Hun had not completely sunk into their later degradation, so that our vessel was made legitimate prize, whilst we of her crew were treated with all the fairness and consideration due to us as naval prisoners. So liberal indeed was the discipline of our captors that 5 days after we were taken, I managed to escape alone in a small boat with water and provisions for a good length of time. When I finally found myself adrift and free, I had but little idea of my surroundings. Never a competent navigator, I could only guess vaguely by the sun and stars that I was somewhat south of the equator. Of the longitude, I knew nothing, and no island or coastline was in sight. The weather kept fair, and for uncounted days I drifted aimlessly beneath the scorching sun, waiting either for some passing ship or to be cast on the shores of some habitable land. But neither ship nor land appeared, and I began to despair in my solitude upon the heaving vastness of the unbroken blue. The change happened whilst I slept. Its details I shall never know, for my slumber, though troubled and dream-infested, was continuous. When at last I awaked, it was to discover myself half-sucked into the slimy advance of hellish black mire, which extended about me in monotonous undulations as far as I could see, and in which my boat lay grounded some distance away. Though one might imagine that my first sensation would be of wonder at so prodigious and unexpected a transformation of scenery, I was in reality more horrified than astonished, for there was in the air and in the rotting soil a sinister quality which chilled me to the very core. The region was putrid with the carcasses of decaying fish and of other less discernible things which I saw protruding from the nasty mud of the unending plain. Perhaps I should not hope to convey in mere words the unutterable hideousness that can dwell in absolute silence and barren immensity. There was nothing within hearing, and nothing in sight save a vast reach of black slime. Yet the very completeness of the stillness and homogeneity of the landscape oppressed me with a nauseating fear. The sun was blazing down from a sky which seemed to me almost black in its cloudless cruelty, as though reflecting the inky marsh beneath my feet. As I crawled to the stranded boat, I realized that only one theory could explain my position. Through some unexpected volcanic upheaval, a portion of the ocean must have been thrown to the surface, exposing regions which for innumerable millions of years had lain hidden under unfathomable watery depths. So great was the extent of the new land which had risen beneath me that I could not detect the faintest noise of the surging ocean, strain my ears as I might. Nor were there any sea fowl to prey on the dead things. For several hours I sat thinking or brooding in the boat, which lay upon its side and afforded a slight shade as the sun moved across the heavens. As the day progressed, the ground lost some of its stickiness, and seemed likely to dry sufficiently for traveling purposes in a short time. That night I slept but little, and the next day I made for myself a pack containing food and water, preparatory to an overland journey in search of the vanished sea and possible rescue. On the third morning I found the soil dry enough to walk upon it with ease. The odor of the fish was maddening, but I was too much concerned with graver things to mind so slight an evil, and set out boldly for an unknown goal. All day I forged steadily westward, guided by a faraway hummock which rose higher than any other elevation on the rolling desert. That night I encamped, and on the following day I still traveled towards the hummock, though that object seemed scarcely nearer than when I had first espied it. By the fourth evening I attained the base of the mound, which turned out to be much higher than it had appeared from a distance, an intervening valley setting it out in sharper relief from the general surface. Too weary to ascend, I slept in the shadow of the hill. I know not why my dreams were so wild that night, but ere the warning and fantastically gibbous moon that had risen far above the eastern plain, I was awake in a cold perspiration, determined to sleep no more. Such visions I had experienced were too much for me to endure again, and in the glow of the moon I saw how unwise I had been to travel by day. Without the glare of the parching sun, my journey would cost me less energy. Indeed, I now felt quite able to perform the ascent, which had deterred me at sunset. Picking up my pack, I started for the crest of the eminence. I have said that the unbroken monotony of the rolling plain was a source of vague horror to me, but I think my horror was greater when I gained the summit of the mound and looked down the other side into an immeasurable pit or canyon, whose black recesses the moon had not yet soared high enough to illuminate. I felt myself on the edge of the world, peering over the rim into a fathomless chaos of eternal night. Through my terror ran a curious reminiscence of Paradise Lost and Satan's hideous climb through the unfashioned realms of darkness. As the moon climbed higher in the sky, I began to see the slopes of the valley were not quite so perpendicular as I had imagined. Ledges and outcroppings of rock afforded fairly easy footholds for a descent, whilst after a drop of a few hundred feet, the declivity became very gradual. Urged on by an impulse which I cannot definitely analyze, I scrambled with difficulty down the rocks and stood on the gentler slope beneath, gazing into the Stygian deeps where no light had yet penetrated. All at once my attention was captured by a vast and singular object on the opposite slope, which rose steeply about 100 yards ahead of me, an object that gleamed whitely in the newly bestowed rays of the ascending moon. That it was merely a giant piece of stone, I soon assured myself, but I was conscious of a distant impression that its contour and position were not altogether the work of nature. A closer scrutiny filled me with sensations I cannot express, for despite its enormous magnitude and its position in an abyss which had yawned at the bottom of the sea since the world was young, I perceived a doubt that the strange object was a well-shaped monolith, whose massive bulk had known the workmanship, and perhaps the worship, of living and thinking creatures. Dazed and frightened, yet not without a certain thrill of the scientist or archaeologist's delight, I examined my surroundings more closely. The moon, now near the zenith, shone weirdly and vividly above the towering steps that hemmed in the chasm, and revealed the fact that a far-flung body of water flowed at the bottom, winding out of sight in both directions, and almost lapping at my feet as I stood on the slope. Across the chasm, the wavelets washed the base of the Cyclopean monolith, on whose surface I could now trace both inscriptions and crude sculptures. The writing was in a system of hieroglyphics unknown to me, and unlike anything I had ever seen in books, consisting for the most part of conventionalized aquatic symbols such as fishes, eels, octopi, crustaceans, mollusks, whales, and the like. Several characters obviously represented marine things which are unknown to the modern world, but whose decomposing forms I had observed on the ocean-risen plain. It was the pictorial carving, however, that did most to hold me spellbound. Plainly visible above the intervening water on account of their enormous size were an array of bas-reliefs whose subjects would have excited the envy of Doré. I think if these things were supposed to depict men, at least a certain sort of man, that the creatures were shewn disporting like fishes in waters of some marine grotto, or paying homage at some monolithic shrine which appeared to be under the waves as well. Of their faces and forms I dare not speak in detail, for mere remembrance makes me grow faint. Grotesque upon the imagination of Poe or Bulwer, they were damnably human in general outline, despite webbed hands and feet, shockingly wide and flabbing lips, glassy, bulging eyes, and other features less pleasant to recall. Curiously enough, they seemed to have been chiseled badly out of proportion with their scenic background, for one of the creatures was shewn in the act of killing a whale, represented as but little larger than him himself. I remarked, as I say, their grotesqueness and strange size, but in a moment decided that they were merely the imaginary gods of some primitive fishing or seafaring tribe. Some tribe whose last descendant had perished eras before the first ancestor of the Piltdown or Neanderthal man was born. Awestruck at this unexpected glimpse into the past beyond the conception of most daring anthropologist, I stood musing, whilst the moon cast queer reflections on the silent channel before me. Then suddenly I saw it. With only a slight churning to mark its rise to the surface, the thing slid into view above the dark waters. Vast, Polymetheus-like and loathsome, it darted like a stuporous monster of nightmares to the monolith, about which it flung its giant, scaly arms, while it bowed its hideous head and gave vent to certain measured sounds. I think I went mad then. Of my frantic ascent to the sloping cliff, and of my delirious journey back to the stranded boat, I remember little. I believe I sang a great deal and laughed oddly when I was unable to sing. I have indistinct recollections of a great storm sometime after I reached the boat. At any rate, I know I heard peals of thunder and other tones which nature utters only in her wildest moods. When I came out of the shadows, I was in San Francisco Hospital, brought thither by the captain of the American ship which picked up my boat mid-ocean. In my delirium, I had said much, but found that my words had been given scant attention. Of any land upheaval in the Pacific, my rescuers knew nothing, nor did they deem it necessary to insist upon a thing which I knew they could not believe. Once I sought out a celebrated ethnologist and amused him with peculiar questions regarding the ancient Philistine legend of Dagon, the fish god. But soon perceiving that he was hopelessly conventional, I did not press in my inquiries. It is night, especially when the moon is gibbous and waning, that I see the thing. I tried morphine, but the drug has given only transient surcease, and has drawn me into its clutches as a hopeless slave. So now I am to end it all, having written a full account for the information or the contemptuous amusement of my fellow men. I often ask myself if it could not have all been a pure phantasm, a mere freak of fever as I lay sun-stricken and raving in the open boat after my escape from the German man of war. This I ask myself, but ever does there come before me a hideously vivid vision in reply. I cannot think of the deep sea without shuddering at the nameless things that may at this very moment be crawling and floundering on its slimy bed, worshipping their ancient stone idols and carving their own detestable likenesses on submarine obelisks of water-soaked granite. I dream of a day when they may rise above the billows to drag down in their reeking talons the remnants of a puny, war-exhausted mankind. Of a day when the land shall sink, and the dark ocean floor shall ascend amidst universal pandemonium. The end is near. I hear a noise at the door as some immense slippery body lumbering against it. It shall not find me. God, the hand! The window! The window!
Well, that's it. All the toilet paper is in the trees in Old Man Finnerty's yard. All the rotten eggs have been smooshed in little kids' hair. And all of the trick-or-treaters have puked up their sweet tarts and gone to bed. Time for me to hose down the crypt and crawl off to sleep myself. Now, get the hell off my lawn!
You can sponsor an episode of this or any other of your favorite Two True Freaks affiliated shows. Simply click the PayPal link on our website, donate any amount at all, tell us which show you're choosing and what message, if any, you'd like us to read on your behalf, and you will be an official sponsor of that show's very next episode, with your message read in the show's opener. It's that easy, and there is no minimum donation. Be a show sponsor today.
If you shop at Amazon.com, please consider using the link at TwoTrueFreaks.com to shop there. If you use this link to go to Amazon and then you shop, Two True Freaks gets a little cut of what you buy, and it doesn't cost you anything extra. So you get to shop as usual and help out the Two True Freaks at the same time.
Welcome to Amazon. I love you.
Visit our brand new website at TwoTrueFreaks.com.
Two True Freaks is always spelled TwoTrueFreaks. Join our forum at forumforgeeks.com, where you can discuss all of the shows on our feed with us and your fellow listeners.
You can find Two True Freaks on Facebook. Just search for Two True Freaks.
And hey, you can friend me, Scott Gardner, on Facebook too. My name is spelled S-C-O-T-T-G-A-R-D-N-E-R.
You can friend me on Facebook too, if you can find me.
Now available, Two True Freaks t-shirts. See our website for details.
Two True Freaks is a very proud member of the Comics Podcast Network. You can check that out at www.comicspodcast.com, where you can hear our new episodes when we put them up.
We are also members of the League of Comic Book Podcasts. For more information, visit comicbooknoise.com/league.
If you ever leave your house and you actually have friends, why don't you tell them about Two True Freaks? Thanks for listening.
And join us every Monday for new episodes of
Two True Freaks.
were finally invited aboard one of these spacecraft, which landed near Ann Arbor, Michigan on October the 24th of 1954. This is a drawing of the craft. As I was leaving the craft, the commander, Soltek, said, "Soon others of your people will be able to have an experience similar to this."